From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you had the opportunity to go on a mission to another planet, would you do it? I'm talking with current technology. No Star Wars hyperdrive, no Star Trek transporter rooms. What if I told you you'd have to live in a 1,700-square-foot box with four other people? And you'd have very little contact with the outside world. And it would last a year. Now what if I told you this mission was not in outer space, but here on Earth? Nathan Jones, an emergency room doctor from Springfield, Illinois, heard all about that and said, sign me up. He was part of NASA's Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog, or CHPEA. It was the first of a series of missions to simulate life on Mars. Here's NASA's Steve Kerner welcoming the crew members home, or really out of isolation, back in July.
378 days ago, these four dedicated individuals who you're about to meet entered this 3D printed 1,700 square foot Mars habitat simulation. They have spent more than a year in this habitat conducting crucial science, most of it nutrition based and how that impacts their performance, but crucial science as we prepare to send people onto the red planet.
Joining us now from Springfield is Dr. Nathan Jones, one of the four CHPEA crew members. Dr. Jones, welcome to the 21st show.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Listeners, you can join the conversation as well. What questions do you have about living in NASA's Mars simulation? And would you ever take part in a mission like this? You can join us at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, Dr. Jones, why did you want to participate in this mission?
Yeah, so kind of same things you sort of already mentioned, just a once in a lifetime sort of experience and opportunity to have just kind of opportunity to put a fingerprint on those first hands that go to Mars, and just a once in life unique experience that it was. Yep.
You know, I feel a little guilty if I take too long on a grocery run. How did your friends and family and workplace react to this?
Yeah, they were all very actually welcoming of the opportunity. So I was very glad for that, especially, you know, my family, who I've got three kids here in Springfield and a spouse here. And, you know, there were some hard times they knew that they were going to expect to have, but, you know, just excited about this just chance to do something unique. And, you know, I don't think I would have been as successful at it if I didn't have such a supportive family and group of friends here and colleagues at work.
So you were the CHPEA medical officer, and I think the NASA website also listed you as an expert communicator. What was your role on this mission?
Yeah, so I was the crew medical officer, and so they selected me that because I am a physician, and I do have experience many different fields. I've got experience as a flight physician, flying with OSF Life Flight in Peoria years ago, and then international medical missions. We travel down to Central America every year and spend time taking care of a population of indigenous people down there, and then also spend time working with EMS and tactical SWAT teams here in the area as well. So on top of that, working as an emergency medicine physician in Springfield and local areas.
So how did you make use of your medical training on this mission?
You know, that's a really an interesting question. So thankfully, NASA selects people to be astronauts and analog astronauts who are actually very healthy. And so most of the medicine involved with NASA's trips are actually, you know, preventative care and those sorts of things. And medical issues do pop up. And, you know, I would have been the first sort of line of defense if any emergencies happened. And then whenever any medical issue pops up, again, sort of the first person to step in and do something until the team at Mission Control, the actual physicians back in Houston, can take over and make their recommendations. And that's basically the way it operates in space. But if you're a physician on a mission to space, you're not really probably doing much medicine in the end. You're actually probably working just as one of the regular crew members in the day-to-day tasks. And again, that's because they send such healthy people to space in general for these longer missions, except for, for instance, potentially some of the private missions that have been ongoing the last couple of years. But generally, very healthy people, and thankfully, they haven't really had many significant medical issues. And so, most of the things that you would do would just be the work as a regular crew member. And so, I think the most important part of it is just taking those skills as you learned to become a physician, and that you learn in your other work, and being able to apply them to other daily tasks as an astronaut.
If someone's on a multi-year mission to Mars, they're months journey away from returning to Earth, they need an appendectomy. A decision needs to be made in space. What were your protocols if someone had sort of an acute, severe medical issue in this simulation?
Yeah, and so ours would have been slightly different than a true mission in space. The further we get away, the more difficult it will be, as you mentioned, to actually find a solution. And NASA does have protocols for those sorts of things. As far as our mission goes, because we were actually Earth-based and at Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, we would have probably pulled the crew member out. They would have had to decide if, hey, is there a way that we can do this to where the crew member doesn't really feel the effects of being pulled out of the mission? Would it violate, the basically the parameters of the mission to be able to pull them out, perform some sort of procedure, and then put that back in? Now, if it was an appendectomy, I assume that they probably would have been done with the mission most likely. But if, for instance, you sprained an ankle, needed an X-ray, something like that, they would have found a way most likely to have obtained some imaging and then made a decision before deciding to pull someone out of the mission. So it probably depended just based on more of the specifics of the injury in that case. Now, if you're in space on the International Space Station, for instance, an appendectomy isn't going to be possible. You're probably, honestly, a couple days out from being able to get something done. So you're probably looking at taking some sort of antibiotic and then trying to find the quickest, safest way to get you back into the United States into a hospital there. Now, as we get to the moon and further away, you're days away from anything like that. And so, they've done some recent surgery studies to see, is there something we can do using like a virtual robot operated by a surgeon on Earth, and that sort of thing. And those are some technologies we're still looking into.
Yeah, and this may be beyond your area of expertise, but I wonder what the lack of gravity or microgravity would do to, what earthbound surgical procedures have learned over the centuries. All right, let me remind listeners actually that we're speaking with Dr. Nathan Jones, who's an emergency room physician in Springfield at Memorial Hospital. He was one of the first four crew members to take part in a NASA Mars simulation, living in isolation here on Earth at the Johnson Space Center for more than a year. So we heard in that clip at the beginning that a lot of the research was nutrition based. What was that like day to day for you?
I don't think I've ever really been a picky eater. I think that that was probably one of the things that they were looking for in the specific crew members that they would select for something like this. So I think if you look at the current missions to the International Space Station, they actually get quite a bit of fresh food sent up with resupply missions and that sort of thing. In general, I think that the foods were good, but we were limited to only foods that would have been the meals ready to eat or thermal stabilized. It would be similar to what the military eats. And then we were also eating foods that were freeze dried, and you would basically add water, to those ones. And so, in general, I thought that the foods were actually pretty good. But, the downside to space foods in general are that most of them tend to be low salt. And that's because as you go into space, you lose gravity that tends to pull the fluids down to your lower body. So if you've ever noticed, if you get swelling, you tend to be developing it in your feet and your legs. Well, in space, that same swelling tends to happen also in your face. And so I think most of the astronauts kind of feel like they've got a cold whenever they get to space, and they have loss of taste. So one of the things they do to combat those symptoms, they select low salt foods for space. And so I think that kind of makes the foods, definitely less appealing in general. And so I think it kind of adds a little bit to some of the menu fatigue that they experience. So one of the big parts of the mission, as he mentioned, were just, are these foods and systems and exercises and activity levels that humans could sustain on the moon or later on Mars?
So are you like literally filling out surveys about taste and appeal and how you feel about it, or are they weighing you, or are you hooked up to monitors of some sort? What is the actual science? How is it actually being studied?
So all of the above and more. So I don't think I can give the details on the specifics of those testings they're doing, but absolutely. So part of that would be surveys. Part of it's just logging which foods you chose and if you ate all of it. And then other parts of it would be, looking how does your weight change day to day, week to week, month by month, looking at that with different levels of exertion, different exercises, those sorts of things.
What was a typical day like for you and your crewmates?
So it actually tried to mirror what would be occurring currently on the International Space Station, as that is probably our best model for what we would continue to implement in future missions. And so a very rigid designated time. So wake up in the morning. Usually you're looking at like 6 in the morning, and then you've got probably a little bit of time to get up, wake up, get some things ready, chat with your crew members. If you drink coffee, maybe you're getting something like that. And then you get breakfast, and then you have a little bit of time designated for the crew to get together and talk about the day's tasks and pre-plan. And then you get to work doing the tasks of the day. Mostly you're looking at science operations, maintenance, those sort of things. And then potentially something for lunch. Usually it's going to be separate from the other crew members, followed by the regular other activities like science and maintenance throughout the afternoon. And then dinner usually be together as a crew, and maybe a couple more hours of activities that were scheduled, followed by an hour or two in the evening where you would kind of get to self-select what you were going to do. Now, then by 10 p.m., I think you are going to be looking at lights out every day. And inside those days, you'd also have a few other activities like public outreach. You might have some time to, I can't remember what they call them, but basically they were educational blocks where they let you select a kind of educational track to kind of stimulate your mind and continue to learn.
Interesting. So I also understand that communication, and this makes sense in space, it takes a long time for messages to travel between Mars and Earth. We've seen that with some of the probes we've sent there. What was that like? I understand that they tried to incorporate that into the simulation. So how much contact did you have with the outside world, and what was it like?
Absolutely. So that was probably one of the bigger parts of the mission. NASA wants to see just how it affects crew morale for to have, excuse me, to have that isolation of time limitation and bandwidth limitations whenever you're communicating with mission control and others back at Earth. And so we were able to mostly just communicate with mission control through sort of a specific messaging like application that the NASA developed specifically for their program. And it was time delayed, which changed throughout the mission. And then we also had
When you say messaging app, is it like you're typing, or it's voice recordings, or how is that?
both. So
Okay.
if you think of like an app that you would use on your phone, you could add to it maybe a picture or maybe a short video, but mostly you're talking about typing a message.
Okay.
And I think that was probably something they'd selected based on feedback from NASA's actually done many similar short-term missions in the past and participated in those, whether it's high seas in Hawaii, NEMO, which is underwater, and then there's the NEK with Russia. And then HERA is actually a mission that NASA does at Johnson Space Center that are usually 45-day long missions. And so they've kind of taken those missions and applied what they've learned to them to develop this sort of app.
We need to take a break in about a minute and a half, but I imagine you were pretty far removed from news events happening on Earth over the past year. Did you get updates on that from Mission Control, or what was that like?
Yes, absolutely. NASA's Mission Control did provide us with a certain amount of curated news and media information for us.
Interesting. And what was it like catching up with, and I should say, I think this mission ended in July. So what was it like sort of coming back into this very information dense environment we live in 2024?
I think one of the hardest things about finishing the mission was just that adjustment to the pace of life on the outside. Everything, your entire schedule in life is essentially scheduled to the minute whenever you're in the mission. And then you stepped out, and all of a sudden you have just so much coming at you. Basically, they hand you your cell phone back, which, has all the blinking, buzzing, and ringing, and all those sort of things. And so it was a little bit overwhelming at first just to step out. And maybe even we were rescued just a little bit because we were hit by a hurricane just after, maybe a day after we got out of the mission. And so it kind of lost all of the telecommunications in Houston
Oh,
for a
wow.
couple of days. And maybe that just kind of rescued me just a little bit because of that. Gave me some time to adjust.
Yeah, well, you were used to that. All right, we're going to continue with Dr. Nathan Jones, emergency room physician from Springfield, who was one of four crew members to take part in NASA's CHIPIA simulated Mars mission for more than a year. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. More after this break. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with Dr. Nathan Jones, an emergency room physician at Springfield Memorial Hospital. He was one of the first four crew members to take part in a NASA Mars simulation. It was called the Crew Health and Performance Exploration Analog, or CHIPIA, and they were in Texas for a year, but it simulated more than a year of life on Mars. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. So you all had to celebrate birthdays and holidays together. Is there fun on a mission like this? What was that like?
Absolutely. Yeah. So they always ensured we had time to enjoy special events. And unfortunately, we were a bit limited on what activities we could do. And they did give us a certain amount of weight of our own personal belongings that we were able to bring along with the missions. And we each sort of reserved some amount of that weight related space to bring things. And we sort of kind of assigned different things between us to bring. And so, for instance, you might be bringing some of those super lightweight cardboard sort of hats, that you think of people wearing on New
Oh, the
Year's
pointy
Eve.
hats, yeah.
Yeah, the pointy hats. Yeah, and so we'd recycle those maybe in birthdays and maybe wrap them with something else or kind of decorate them separately to feel like it was something different. Took a collapsible, I think, sort of Christmas tree made out of sort of a tinsel, and we found some paper and drew ornaments and created our own ornaments for it. Had some those really thin LED strips that change colors, and so we took a couple of those and we were able to use those in for you'd change them to blue and red for the 4th of July, which we experienced two of during the mission, and you might change them to red and green for Christmas, which is upcoming here, and that sort of thing. So just a lot of creativity involved.
Yeah. It strikes me that in our modern era, we are so divorced from ideas of boredom, at least those of us with smartphones. People are waiting in line at the grocery store. They pull out the phone, they're scrolling. There's almost hardly a minute that goes by that cannot be occupied with games or reading or communicating. And so boredom is something that people have lost. And there are people who say maybe we're less creative because of that. I wonder if you learned anything about boredom and the way our minds work during this year.
Oh, absolutely. I think a couple of points there. The first was one that kind of surprised me just a little bit. I found I actually enjoyed when I really thought about it, some of those, I'll call them slower moments. You know, life just speeds by so quickly, and I'm always so busy. And all of a sudden, I have these moments where everything just kind of slows down. And I really found if I really thought about it, I could enjoy just how life wasn't speeding by for once. But beyond that, there weren't a whole lot of those moments because I found ways to utilize them for other things. I started learning Russian while I was on the mission. I was honing some of my Spanish skills. I was working on a guitar. I started drawing. Many, many new skills were learned during those moments on the mission.
Yeah, talk about that. I read somewhere else that you had started drawing. What form did that take?
So I decided to take in with me basically, I don't know, it's a little maybe larger than a legal pad, sort of set of paper and some pencils, and did a bit of drawing, drew some pictures of my family. Of my spouse, and really kind of I hadn't done any drawing since I was probably in junior high, and just kind of rekindled my affinity of drawing and art and that sort of thing. It was a lot of fun.
Is it something you've stuck with since you've been back in the world?
Honestly, it has not, just because I think I've been so busy, as I mentioned before, just back here on Earth.
So you mentioned how jarring it was to get your smartphone handed back to you. What other sort of transitions have you had to make to, as you said, life on Earth?
Yeah, so I think one of the harder transitions also was back into my work environment. And as you mentioned, I work in the emergency department at Springfield Memorial Hospital. And, you know, just the pace there can be very demanding. And I think when I first came back, it had probably been probably 15 months or so since I had seen patients clinically like that. And so it took a little bit of time to readjust to that. And I feel like I'm pretty much back to it now after a couple of months, but yeah, it really took some time.
And emergency rooms can be that can be a hard road for a doctor. You're seeing some of people at their worst moments, their most painful moments with addictions and other things. Has that do you feel like you have a different approach to medicine now after having this year in isolation?
I certainly like to think so, and that each of the things we do in our lives would affect how you practice medicine in that sort of environment, and really just do any other activity in your life. I couldn't really probably put my finger on exactly what that might be, though.
All right, most of us have expectations going into new experiences. I wonder what your expectations were going into this mission, and then how you might have had those expectations confounded in some ways by what it was actually like.
Yeah, I think that, for the most part, I felt like it was what I was expecting it to be, but maybe one of the things that caught me, you know, off guard, and we live in this culture. I see a lot of times people are kind of racing towards retirement and that sort of thing. One of the things that really surprised me is just how much of my identity is being a physician, in particular being an emergency medicine physician, you know. And I think maybe it's just kind of this weird sort of situation where, you know, you're going into it and you're like, man, I really don't feel like I'm an astronaut. Well, you know, you're not going to true space, but I also don't really feel like I'm even a what we call an analog astronaut. And then partway through the mission, I started feeling like I wasn't really even an emergency medicine physician anymore, just because it had been so long. And so it was a really interesting sort of identity sort of playing around in my mind at that time. And, you know, coming back to Earth and or really still being on Earth, but coming back to my regular life and everything and settling back into it, it was just a sort of interesting thing mentally. And I really do feel like I'm an emergency physician again, but it was interesting realizing, like, man, I really do feel like I'd be lost stepping away from that.
And, you know, one imagines going to another planet would change your perspective on life. And I wonder how participating in this simulation here on Earth might have changed your perspective on life.
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many things I could talk about for that. I think one that stuck out to me in particular is if you think about how Earth and Mars both rotate around the sun, but at different speeds. At one point, they're going to be on, Earth's on one side, sun's in the middle, Mars is on the other side. And I remember just after we had had sort of a conjunction event where they were all aligned like that, and communications were established with Earth, and thinking we had sort of a window set up that they had created with a virtual Mars on the outside of it to look like you had a window to true outside. And it was a really neat thing. But at one moment, I remember looking up and seeing the sun out of that window and realizing that if I was actually on Mars, and keep in mind, we had been sort of trained to think mentally that we were actually there. And so to me, looking out that window and seeing the sun and realizing right next to it, way on the other side, that would be home, would be Earth, would be everything I knew. That was just sort of a wild mental thing for me.
Yeah, what a leap. Would you recommend this experience if other people were ever interested in going to Mars either as a sort of an analog mission as you did, or perhaps strapping themselves to a rocket and spend, committing to a couple of years, as you said, miles
Well,
and miles away? Yeah.
yeah, absolutely. I think if I had the opportunity to do it again, I absolutely would. I would say yes, but qualify it with for the right people. I think NASA spent a lot of time trying to figure out who we should send on a mission like this. And in fact, I think this mission is partly for them to try and get more information as far as who those people should be, because I think it will take a certain skill set to be able to deal with the isolation and other challenges of a mission like that. But
Would you
yeah,
do
I
it?
think it was worth it. Great experience.
Would you do it if NASA comes to you 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and says, you know what? You actually fit the profile to a T. Will you be on, one of our first Mars missions? Would you go?
If I was in a situation where I was isolated in a bubble, I would absolutely love to go. The difficult part there is I've already spent so much time working with NASA and away from my family and all my loved ones. And so I think I'd really have to have a discussion with them before I could commit to something like that.
Dr. Nathan Jones, an emergency room physician at Springfield Memorial Hospital. He was also one of the first four crew members to take part in a NASA Mars simulation known as JAPEA at the Johnson Space Center. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.